for over a year now, so I'm really excited to hear what he has to say. And Kieran, you're up. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Forrest. And my name is Kieran. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 16, 1999. And I actually did join Al-Anon a long time back, and I went to the Queen Anne Al-Anon club up there. Oh, it's just recording, so I need to speak up. All right, I can do that. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, so the talk that I want to that I've thought about tonight. Thank you so much for inviting me, all of you guys. I'm a little bit worried because there's a lot of Water's Edge people here, and they know my talk, and they have some bananas all lined up. But thank you guys for showing up and for driving me down here today. So I want to talk about something that has intrigued me from the very beginning when I got to read the big book, and I didn't read it straight away. In fact, it took me a long time to read it because I was very angry when you forced me to become a member of your group. And I did not want this. This is the last thing in the world I wanted. You can probably tell already that my accent puts me in a different country. I come from Ireland. I come from a very, very serious drinking family in Ireland. They still don't understand why I don't drink. And they say to me things like, why don't you just have one? And I say to them, you have no idea what that means. And they invite me out and I drive them home. And that's a good thing because they can't drive anymore because everything has changed since I left. And I left in a large, large hurry. I did a geographical. I didn't know that at the time. You guys taught me that word, and I was very angry then because I'm a geographer. And again, I had to suffer some more humility. And, you know, the story for me was getting humble enough to be teachable because I'm a teacher and nobody can teach me. And so it was a lot of problems about joining, but I was in such pain I needed to join. But the one thing that stuck out when I read the book that I didn't really get, and it took me a long time to understand it, and it kept kind of creeping into my brain. The first one was that it said on page 86, after all, we have brains to use. And I said, that's a very flippant thing to say. Of course we have brains to use. But of course, we weren't using them. And then, in the next page of the first paragraph up there, it talks about the plane of inspiration. And I thought, I wonder what that is, the plane of inspiration. And it took me a long time to get to that. And I'm going to read a small bit about this plane of inspiration tonight, and then we'll talk about some of the stories. I don't recommend to anybody doing what I did because I didn't start the way you started at step one and go all the ways up. I jumped in at step nine because I wanted those promises. That's all I wanted. And I was lucky enough to survive long enough to get back to step one and start all over again. But that was a long story. So I start on page 87, and it's my morning reading. We are often surprised when the right answers come after we've tried this for a while. I was very surprised. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. And so my job today, I'm a research scientist in neurocognitive science at the University of Washington. Now, for a kid who was homeless and living on the streets, that's a big jump. And if you told me back then that I could do this, I would say you were, you know, anyway. I was told to have no profanity here, and I won't. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas, and we could go into that for a long time, the absurd things that I did. But nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. And that's who it is today. That's who I am today. I rely on the fact that I have come to a place where my mind, I'm using my brain, and I'm using my brain about brain, and I am relying on it every single day because I've got you with me. If I go someplace without you, I don't get very far, and I end up with a lot of resentments. So let's go back to where it started. I was born in Ireland. On my mother's side, there was an amazing amount of alcoholism, so much so that one of my great memories is being about 7 or 8 years old in the farm with my cousin, and my cousin said to me, when I grow up, I don't want to be like my dad. And my dad was my mother's brother, and he was my hero. Not because I didn't know that he was a great drinker or a terrible drinker, because I knew that. But I hid that. I shunned it from me. But because he was a phenomenal musician and a great dancer. And when he danced, oh my God, the world just stopped. It was phenomenal. And he danced when he got drunk. Or when he was getting drunk. Because when he got too drunk, he couldn't dance and it stopped. But the point is that to hear that from this young kid, it just was such an amazing, jarring thing for me to hear. Well, fast forward 50 years, and that young kid, who is the same age as me, he and I were the same age, my cousin, he was picked off the streets of London recently for drinking turpentine and methylated spirits. And he was dragged home, and he was put into a treatment center. It's too late, of course. He's got so much damage done to his brain. And he became his dad. And you know, that was my path as well. But my dad wasn't an alcoholic, but on my mother's side, there was all kinds of alcoholism. And so it was there in the family, and we, being Irish Catholics growing up there, we knew that we would take a pledge at a certain time, age 12 or so, and we wouldn't drink again until we were 21. And that's what I did. Sometime around 12, my mother, who was bored with raising families and we were off to school, she was at home alone, she decided to buy a bar. Buy a bar in Ireland, of course, and it was a very social place. She was very successful. She didn't drink very much herself, but all the customers were alcoholics. I mean, every single last one of them, because our bar was across the road from the distillery where they made the whiskey. And so on their break at lunchtime, these men who drank in the distillery would come across for a break to our pub to get Guinness. Now, think about that. They were drinking pure whiskey before they blended it all day, and they'd take a break to come over for Guinness. And my job at age 12, 13, 14, all the ways up through school was I would have to come home at lunchtime, and I would take over from my mother for these people who came in for, they only had 30 minutes for lunch. And my job was to fill up about 100 pints of Guinness up to about here. And as they came in the door, I would top them off, and I would give them their pints to drink. And that was their lunch. And then they would stagger back to work and drink the real stuff. And then in the evening time, they'd come back again. And the amount of misery and pain that I witnessed from these people, but it wasn't me, it was them, so it was okay. And we had a very clear demarcation. The people who could pay their bills at the end of the week, because nobody charged any money, it was all on the slate. The people who could pay their bills were okay. The people who were standing and could pay their bills were better. The people who were on the floor groveling and miserable, they were alcoholics. So I knew what an alcoholic was from the beginning. And the only thing, the only ambition in life was not to be one of those. Anything else was okay. And so life went on. You know, you were also taught in a country like that, you were taught by the time you were out of college, you should be married, have children, have a house, a car, all that good stuff. And I did all that. I had a beautiful wife, I had two beautiful children, I had a house and a car. And I was just miserable. There was a big hole inside. I didn't know what it was. I just couldn't figure it out. By the way, I'd started drinking in college. And college was absolutely wild. The reason being, I was popular because you bring me to a party, guess what? I had access to all the whiskey you wanted. And so I was brought to all the Irish parties. I brought my guitar and I brought four bottles of whiskey, which I stole from our pub. And I would go up to bed with the bottles of whiskey. And then I'd come out the window, down the tree, and go off to the party. And it went on like that right through college. I don't remember finishing college, but I did graduate, apparently. And I got a job. I got a good job. I didn't expect to get a job, and I planned to emigrate to Australia because that's a long ways away, and they wouldn't know me. And it was a good thing to do. That was my first intentional geographic. However, I went to a funeral the week before I was going to Australia, and I got drunk with the principal of a school, and he said to me, he spoke with a kind of a nasal thing in his nose. He said, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "I'm going to go to Australia." He says, "Oh, no, you could come and teach with us." And I said, no, I don't want to go teach here. I mean, this is like a small town. And so when I went home, I made the mistake of saying this to my mother, and she says, "That's exactly what you were supposed to do." And I'm going, "It is? I thought I was supposed to go to Australia." She said, no, you're supposed to stay here and teach. So I stayed there and teach. And 10 years passed, and I was more and more miserable every week. And I took to drinking to solve that, because when I got drunk, all that pain went away. All that stuff that was inside went away. And somewhere along the line, I crossed a couple of lines that I thought I would never cross. And that had to do with coming home, waking up in somebody else's bed, doing things that I thought I could never do. And I began to dislike myself. And then I had this brilliant flash of insight. We had a 26-foot sloop, my buddy and I, my drinking buddy. And that 26-foot sloop had red sails. It was very beautiful. I see these sails here, and I think, my 26-foot sloop. It was called the Ballyhie. And our plan was, when things got really bad, and they were getting bad, was to sail to the Mediterranean. So we filled this boat up with Jameson. None of that English whiskey. Good whiskey. Irish whiskey. All right. And Aer Lingus TV dinners. And our plan was to go down to the Mediterranean and hide when things got bad. And so everything was going fine, and as the things began to go down, and they were going down pretty fast, and we had the escape hatch, all of that stuff. And then one day, we went on this binge drink sail, because we sailed and drank all the time, and we went down to Cortmacsherry, which is a small, beautiful fishing town down the coast, and there was a pub there called Mary Ann's. If you got to Mary Ann's on a Sunday night before it closed at 10 o'clock, you'd be there all night. But if you got there 5 minutes after 10, she wouldn't let you in. She was a miserable old woman. So the plan was to get there before 10. And as we were sailing into the harbour of Cortmacsherry, the wind died, of course. We got under the lee of the land, and suddenly we were like, paddling and pushing the boat as much as we can, get into shore. We never thought about starting the engine. We were true sailors. And we had a plan. And so we threw the boat up against the pier, tied it up quickly, and ran up, got in before 10 o'clock, and we were there all night. Great night. As we came out in the morning, the tide had come up, 10 feet tide. The boat had got stuck underneath one of the beams, couldn't come up. And our escape to... the escape sank. And so there it was. We were now stuck in Ireland, and things were really getting bad. And I got into trouble. I got into trouble with the police, and suddenly it dawned on me, the TV dinners, Aer Lingus, I could fly out. And so I flew out. And I didn't think about it. I left without telling anybody. Parents, the job, my wife, children, everything, just gone, one day. And that was a very hard thing to come. I didn't think about it for a long time because I was always drunk. I left and I was on my way to Australia. When I came to a few weeks later, I was in Seattle. So it's your fault. I hadn't planned coming. I didn't even know Seattle existed. I mean, if you said you're going to Seattle, I would say you were crazy. That doesn't work. And so I was in Seattle, and I had no money left. I had $4, and I was walking. It was a cold March night. It was very cold. My lips were bleeding from the cold. I was hungry. I went into the deli up there on the Sunnyside. It was called the Sunnyside Deli back then. And I went in there with my $4, and I was very careful about spending money. I talked my way into a room that day, so I had a place to stay for 4 days. I wasn't going to pay at the end of the week. I told them I'd have money then. And so they said I could stay, and they said to me, when are you going to move your stuff in? And I said, I just did. And said, and then I could see their faces that they've taken in a homeless man. And I said, but it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And they let me stay. And I went down to the deli with my $4, and I bought a small little package of tea, a little bit of milk, and a little bit of butter for the bread. And so I had about $1.50 left or something. And I came back to the house, and I boiled up some water, and I made tea, and I poured in the milk, and guess what? I'd never seen anything like this. It was chocolate milk. Who would have thought of chocolate milk? It made no sense. And so I was completely off the boat, knew nothing. And so I was very distraught then, because I thought it was bad milk, and I threw the whole thing out. I had nothing to eat. And I had some dry bread and butter, and that was it. And I started my life in Seattle that way. And then the next day, I was walking along and I came across the Irish flag. It was Murphy's Pub. I was in, straight away. I was a head barman. I was playing music. I was earning money under the table. I was illegal, but I was here. I was doing it. And so I stayed there for a year and a day. And that year and a day, I created unbelievable havoc out of that pub. And I still can't pass 45th Street without, you know. Anyway. But what did happen was I met some other people who were just as bad as me. They were semi-Irish. They were born here, but they were Irish. They would say things like, "Oh, I'm Irish." And I'd say, "Where were you born?" In some little small town in Nantucket or someplace. I'd say, "But that's not Ireland." I'd say, "Oh, yes, it is." And so I had to learn that too, that people who weren't born there were Irish as well. And I had to accept that. And so I got this new family of drunks who were Irish. And I didn't know their names or know anything about them except that we all drank together. And so one of them became my sponsor for immigration. He said to me, "If you come and work for me," and he was going to open an Irish bar and I was going to run it. That wouldn't have lasted very long, I don't think. But he said he'd sponsor my immigration. So I signed up for that. And I stayed in Seattle and he signed up as my sponsor. And it took 6 years. I spent 6 years illegal and I ran his business for 6 years. And part of that business was he had four things. He had the bar, which he hired me for. He had an agency for employment, and he had a real estate company, and he also had something called a publishing company. And the only piece I wanted was the publishing company. So I made a bargain with him. I said, "I'll run your bars for a year, but at the end of that year, I want to move into the publishing business." And he said, "Okay." Well, he didn't keep his word, and I spent 6 years in the bar. And eventually, I bought the publishing company from him. But what happened was this, and this is the critical piece that brings the story to where we are tonight. I was I was making no money, of course, and drinking everything I did make. And I was living up on 45th Street in Stoneway. There's a building there right now where there's Walgreens. Well, before they put the other three stories on it, there was only one story to it. He built it. And he ran out of money, so there was only one story. And the elevator shaft was empty, so I lived in the elevator shaft. I was basically homeless. And so I've been there in the elevator shaft one night when this man shows up. and he came to the outside office, and they came back to me. And so I was playing this awful game with the INS, as well as the IRS and anything else that had I with it. And so the INS were the people I really worried about because I was illegal. I shouldn't have been, you know, here at all. And I couldn't understand why they didn't want me. But they didn't, and I was, you know, playing games with them. And so one night this man showed up and he said, do you have a publishing company? And I said, "Yes." I mean, I'm homeless, basically. And he looked like Columbo. He had... you know, that old coat on, and he wasn't washed, and he was just, he looked like he was more homeless than me. And so I knew immediately that this was a plan from the INS and that they were tracking me. And so he said to me, "I have a manuscript and I'd like you to publish it." I said, "Okay, if you just give me the manuscript, I will pass it to my editorial board and I'll get back to you in a few days." And he gave me the manuscript and he said, "Thank you very much." And I said, "Do you have another copy of this?" He said, "No, this is the only copy." It was in a brown paper bag like this. And I thought, "Oh my God, these guys are really slick. They're good." And so I took this little manuscript and I said goodbye to him. And Mr. Colombo left and went out. And I thought, wow, they're onto me now. And I put the thing down and I didn't look at it for a long time. But when I did open it up, it was a huge shock. It said, a concordance to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know what a concordance was, and I didn't know what the Big Book of Alcoholics... I didn't even know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I knew there were things like alcoholics who were lying on the floor throwing up and not paying their bills. I knew that. But I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was, and I didn't know what a concordance was. And I looked at it, and it was a complete list of concepts and page numbers and things. And I thought, whoa, look at this weird stuff. And so I thought, now they're really, really bugging me. So I went to the library, and I met the librarian there in charge of the reference librarian. And I said to her, "Do you know what the word concordance means?" She says, "Yes, I do." And she said, in her, you know, glasses on her nose, she says, it's a relational database of concepts and ideas. I said, oh, why would you use that? She said, well, you wouldn't use it, but a priest might use it, or a person who's giving a lecture on something like the Bible, because the Bible has all these things in it, and if you want to find things like love or deceit or any of those words, you just look up the concordance, and then you go to the pages, and you've got your lecture made up. I thought, so why would you want a concordance to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And she said, oh, well, that book was printed in 1935. There was about 1 million copies of it out there, and they didn't put an index in it. So you need to have some way of figuring out where all the pieces are in there, all the concepts. And I said, so who are these Alcoholics Anonymous? She says, you don't want to have anything to do with them. This I knew. And I said, so if I had a concordance to this big book of Alcoholics, would it be valuable? She said, oh, yes, they sell over 1 million copies a year. And I'm thinking, ooh, that would be good. That would be very good. I said, how would I get to know these people? She said, well, she said, and she goes and she looks up a few things. She says, they have a world headquarters in New York on Avenue of the Americas up in the 11th floor. And here's the number. Call them up and talk to them. And so I went back and I borrowed a phone. And I called up world headquarters of AA in New York City. And I said to them in my best, you know, educated accent, I said, are you world headquarters of AA, of Alcoholics Anonymous? And she said, yes. And she said, I said, do you publish the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? She said, yes, we do. I said, do you have an index for that big book? She says, no, we don't. I said, would you like an index? No, we would not. I said, okay. That was fast. And I was about to hang up. And she says, well, wait. She said, wait a while. Actually, I'm looking at the agenda for the meeting on Thursday. And it says, number 6 on the agenda says, index. So, yes, we would like to know. So, do you have one? I said, yes, I do, actually. And I was holding it out of my hand so she could see it. You know. And so she said, well, please bring us 7 copies. I said, of course, I will. 7 copies. She said, please be here on Wednesday. And I said, okay, I'll do that. Now, this was Monday. And I thought, okay. And I thought, okay, so New York can't be too far. And so I could probably buy a ticket and go there. So what I didn't think through was this. And I did make 7 copies, by the way, at Kinko's. And it didn't cost too much. And I had them. I had the 7 copies, you know, with staples on them and stuff. So I had the copies. And what I didn't think about was this, that here, like today, it's, you know, you could go dressed like this. In New York, it's minus 40 or something. You know, it's snowing and awful. And so I had only one shoe. The other shoe had no sole in it. And I had cardboard in it. And I borrowed a short coat and I had my shirt and that was it. I bought a one-way ticket because I knew I was going to make a fortune there and come back later. So I bought a one-way ticket on the last piece of money on my borrowed credit card. And so I go to New York and I arrive in the Avenue of the Americas. Now remember this, when I left Ireland less than a year before that, I was on my way to Australia and I came to in Seattle. And that was not a good thing for me. It was very disconcerting. And so, because I had a job in Australia, I think. And they would have treated me better down there, I'm sure. So I go to New York, and I get in the elevator on this building on the Avenue of the Americas, and I go up to the 11th floor, and the elevator opens, and there it happened again. I come to, and I'm in Seattle. There's the Space Needle, there's Lake Union. I recognize it this time. And there's the mountains, there's Mount Rainier. And I think, oh, damn. And I didn't remember, you know, all the drinking part in between, but I knew it happened before. So I got back in the elevator and I went down. And somewhere down around the 4th or 5th floor, somebody got on. And I said to them, is this New York or Seattle? And they looked at me and they said, it's New York. And I thought, okay, maybe it's just the brain thing again, because we do have brains. And so I went back up again, and I stepped out, and there it was again, the entire thing. And this time I hung on. I said, okay. I said, is this Seattle or New York? He said, do you like our mural? They said, do you like this? They had done the entire wall of the inside office in the shape of Seattle. They had the Space Needle, Mount Rainier, the lake, the whole lot, because they were planning for the the convention in 1990. And so this... And the convention was in Seattle, right? And I'm sure you guys were at that convention. I was here, but I didn't go to the convention. And so I went in, and Ruth was up at the desk, and I said to her, I came in from Seattle, I've got the 7 copies of the index. And I was expecting her to say, yeah, come on in, here's the money. And she said, thank you very much, we'll get in touch with you. And I said, when will you get in touch with me? And she looked at me over the rim of the floor, and she says, you know, one thing you must understand, the wheels of AA turn very slowly. We'll call you in a couple of years. And I'm going, I don't have any money. And I'm thinking to myself, oh man, this is not what I expected. So she ushered me out, and now I'm going back down again. And now the cold is really beginning to feel, because the cardboard is now wet, and the shoe. And so I'm standing out in the snow in New York City, and I'm thinking, I'm screwed now. This is not good. And so I walk around, and I see the Irish flag up over the Tommy Makem's pavilion. And I walk in, and who's up on stage playing music? Only some of my friends from Ireland. So I'm up on stage 5 minutes later playing music, and by midnight, I'm absolutely drunk. But the problem was, and this was a really serious problem for me, I had gotten used to drinking here in Seattle, where you close the bars around 2 o'clock. In New York, they didn't close. And so I missed my, you know, my whole pace was wrong. And so at some time around 1 o'clock, we took a taxi and we went to the Glockamara, which is up in the other side of town. And after that, I don't remember anything else. I just remember going in there, and then I came out of my blackout. I was in the street somewhere in Manhattan, I don't know where. It was snowing like crazy. I was shivering, and there was nobody out. It was probably 4 in the morning, 5 o'clock, I don't know. It was just awful, and I knew then I was going to die. I knew that I couldn't survive this. It was too cold. I had nothing. I was drunk. And I was coming out of this awful haze, and suddenly a police car pulled in. And there was 2 black policemen in there, and I was absolutely frozen. And I thought, well, there's only one hope for this, you know, because I didn't want to be deported in that state. You can't be sent back with only one shoe. And so I thought the only hope here is to attack. After all, we have brains to use. It's on page 87. And so they wound down the window, and I looked in and I said, now don't give me any trouble. I said, I know you're Irish and I want you to take me home. And they said, get in the back, Paddy. And I sat in the back, it was nice and warm, and they said, where are you staying? And I gave them a car that I had taken, obviously, out of the motel that I had booked into down in Queens or someplace. And they took me to a subway, and they told the driver or the guard on the subway, put this man on bus number 6 and make sure he gets to this place. And they took care of me. And so that was one of the miracles that was happening when I didn't know miracles happened. And I don't remember anything else after getting into the back of their car. And I came to, and I was in my motel room, and I was lying flat down on the bed. I was still dressed, and the television was in the snowy thing. You know that sound? And I had a most unbelievable headache. I mean, it was awful, awful. I blame New York. And so I realized then that I was woken up by the phone ringing. And I picked up the phone, and it said, is this Mr. O'Mahony? I said, yes. And I shouldn't have said it that loud because it was hurting my head. And it said, this is AA World Headquarters. And I'm thinking, how do they know? They're after me again. How do they know? I mean, I was out drinking all night. They must know. And I said, yes. He says, we like your index. We want you to publish. And I'm saying, what index? And I said, you gave us 7 copies of an index yesterday. Oh, yeah, you like that? Yes, we want you to publish it. And they hung up. And I'm going. And then I collapsed again. And the next time I came to, the phone was ringing again. And it was the people at the front desk. I went downstairs, they said my credit card didn't work, I was arrested. And to make a long story short, it wasn't easy to get back to Seattle. I did get back to Seattle a week or so after that, and I immediately started publishing this book. I published the book, we brought out 1,000 copies. There's 6 or 7 people on the book that have their names with their first name and their last name only, like Kieran O or something like that. And there's one name with the full name in there, because I was not an alcoholic. And so the book was published, and of course it sold like hotcakes, like that. Boom, boom, boom. But I made a big mistake. I didn't know anything about business, of course, and what happened was, I didn't understand that you had to print at this price and sell at this price to make a profit. I didn't do any profit stuff, so it just barely broke even. And so I was struggling to try and live, and I was painting houses and playing music. I played at the Pig at the Pies Pig Market for years, playing music there to make money. And so eventually I made enough money to print a second copy, and I went on the road. I borrowed a car, and I drove from Seattle to San Diego, from San Diego all the way across to Boston. It was the weekend of the Boston Marathon. I was there. I was drinking, so I ran the marathon. I didn't actually sign up for it or any of that, but I did run it, and I did finish it in 3 hours and 50-something minutes, which is very good for a drunk. I had the most awful hangover the day after, and I remember coming out of Boston. I was young then, and we got away with it when we were younger. And so that was 1987. I ran the Boston Marathon. And the next day, I drove to New York, because I was still driving with this book in the back of the car. I sold 15,000 copies between here and Florida on that trip. And then I came back to Seattle, and immediately somebody from Hazelden contacted me. I sold the book to Hazelden, and they printed it off, 150,000 copies, and they made a lot of money. And I walked away from the whole project because it was all those alcoholic people. I didn't want anything to do with it. The man who wrote the book was Stuart C. And Stuart was a programmer for IBM. He worked in Alaska on the train systems and stuff, and he was a brilliant programmer. He taught me to program. He taught me computers. So I learned a lot from him. But he also taught me this, and this is the part that really stuck with me. He said he had a photographic memory of the book. And he would ask me, he would say to me, okay, ask me, open the page and say a word, and I'll tell you what page you're on. And he had the entire book in his brain. And the 164 pages, that's all he had. But at the same time, he said to me, I can't stay sober because this is a simple program and I keep complicating it. And so the way I got the book from him was he would force me to go to the supermarket with him, and he would make me buy a lot of food, and he would pay with food stamps, and I would give him the cash, and he would drink that. That's how he made money. I was getting his food stamps, and he was getting my cash. And it was a big deal. And I stayed with him as we edited the book and finished the book. And finally, he made a bargain with me. It was a horrible bargain, but I stayed with the bargain because I was drinking and he was drinking. The bargain was that he would finish the book and sign it off to me if I would take him up to there's a bar up in Capitol Hill. It's an English name bar. I forget the name of it now, but it's like the Royal something. And we would go in there, and we would get drunk together. And at the end of that, he would take me down to detox and sign him in. And we went up there, and we both drank. He got way drunker than me because he was more advanced than I was. I was able to stand up longer than him. And at some point in the evening, I got a cab, took him down to detox, and that was it. From there, he moved to Texas, then he moved back to Chicago. He went to Florida, and he died in Florida. He died drunk. And the point is that he could never get the program. He knew the book more than anybody else. And I learned that lesson without wanting to know the lesson because I was still drinking. In the meantime, the man who is now my sponsor and who sponsored my immigration, because he got to AA before me, and he has now 27 years in the program. He lives in Chicago. He's my sponsor. And he taught me a lot of the beginning steps of AA. But I didn't learn from him because I was fighting it. Today I learned at the Water's Edge West an incredible nuance and a new way of looking at a surrender, because I did not understand surrender. I was brought up to think that surrender was the mistake. Don't ever surrender. And the surrender, the definition we got today was, it's just make a decision to change to the winning side. And the thing is, I hadn't made that decision, and I wasn't ever going to make it until I got to a place where I was so loathsome of myself. I could not stand myself another inch, another minute. And so I was living alone in a small little, it was like an elevator shaft, but it wasn't. It was a one-roomed place in Ballard. And I was living in Ballard because I was managing my life in between the bars. My life wasn't unmanageable. I was managing it nicely. I knew that if I got drunk in this bar, I could make my way downhill home. It was as simple as that. And I knew I was going to get drunk because all I did was live to drink. And even though I still had jobs and I had money. All I did with the money was drink. And so when it came to that day, that evening in Ballard, I was inside in the Old Peculiar, which is a real hovel. It was back then in Ballard. I don't go in there anymore, so I don't know. But back then, 15 years ago, it was a real dive. And I was in there on a Wednesday night, and there was two other people in there. One was a man who sat over there, and he just glared at me. And he always glared at me. I didn't know his name. I didn't know why. And I was upset. I had a resentment against that man that you would not believe. And so the other person in between us was this very hungry-looking older lady who was eyeing both of us, wondering who she might jump on. And I was thinking, oh my God, this is not good. And so I had a beer on the counter, and I looked at the man over there, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to take him on. I'm going to attack him too. So I went over to him, and I said to him, you don't like me, do you? And he said, no, I don't. And I said to him, why not? And he said, I don't have to have a reason. And I said, you know what? That's reason enough. And I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm done with this. And I remember the first time in my entire life, I left without finishing my beer. And as I walked away from that beer, I looked back. I was sitting on the counter. And as I walked away, I kid you not, I saw on that floor, I saw me. I saw my shadow sink down into myself. And I walked away from it. And as I was walking out, and I was drunk enough at the time to be stupid, I picked up a magazine that I also had resentments against. I resented the stranger. Big time. And there's reasons for that too, but they're not important. And so I picked up the stranger. I had never done that before because I had too much of resentment against the stranger to pick it up and take it home. And so I took this thing home, and I think I took it home because I blacked out sometime after that. And in the morning I woke up. Now this little place I was living in, this little hovel, was on the street on 17th. And you know, when I woke up in the morning, I was lying face down again on the floor, and my door was wide open, so all the people walking down were looking in at me. And this time, I wasn't clothed. I had undressed somewhere out on the street as I was coming home. And so I was lying naked on my floor, and my clothes were like down the street, my shoes, my underpants, my all this way, and I thought, ooh, this is not good. So I grabbed the towel, ran out, picked up all my stuff, came back in, and I wasn't feeling too good about life. And it wasn't me. I said, who is this person? Who am I? I was just so upset about that. And then I saw the stranger there, and I opened it up. I don't know why, but I did. And I read, and I never did this before, I read my horoscope. And you won't believe what my horoscope said. It was the weirdest. It scared me to death, right? This is what it said. I cut it out and kept it. It said, This is a message directly for you. And I knew it was for me. I knew it. It was either the IRS or it was, you know, AA World Headquarters. It was a message to me. It said, this message comes from your cousin in the Pleiades. Up there, the Pleiades. And his name was, and there was only all consonants. There was no vowels. It was all consonants. There were seven consonants, like N, X, V, P, L was his name. And I'm going, oh my God, I have a cousin with this name from the Pleiades who is now giving me a message. And the message was this: you are very sick, get help now. And I'm going, oh my God. And so what do I do? Well, at that time I was working at Microsoft. Me and Bill Gates. I had a very good job. I had an office with a door you could lock. And I was a manager. I was paid a lot of money, and I went there. But instead of going to work, what I used to do when I got to my office was I'd lock the door, and I would get under my desk and hide. And I hid, like, scared, because I was afraid they'd find out, first of all, that I couldn't do anything, and secondly, that I'd been drinking all night and that I had an awful headache. I couldn't look at computers because the screen was buzzing at me. And so I went to my office in Microsoft, and I called AA because I knew what to do. Because somebody along the line had said it, you know, Stuart or my ex-partner who was now in alcoholic for 15 years. And so I called them up and I said to them, Is there any meetings here? And they say, yes, actually, there is one at noon, and it's down there, and it's the Bellevue
Alamo Club.
Alamo Club. And so I thought, oh, God. And so I stayed under my desk hiding. I actually got up, and I did write one very, very serious curse on a woman in Gaelic on my whiteboard. And then I went back underneath the desk. You don't want me writing curses for you in Gaelic, believe me. Bad thing to do. So that's a resentment too. And so I went at noon, actually 11:30, and I parked about four blocks away, and I kind of walked carefully up there, and I didn't go in for a long time because I didn't want to be seen. And eventually I thought, well, they'll see me out here, so I better go in. And so I went in, and I sat down, and I sat near the front table. And when they said, do you need a sponsor? I said, yeah. And says, that's your sponsor over there. And that was it. He was my sponsor. He's still my sponsor, Ron. And, you know, I'm not going to say anything bad about Ron beyond the fact that he can't read nor write. And Ron says only one thing when there's a problem. This too shall pass. I hated Ron. More than anybody else, I hated Ron because he would say, don't worry, keep coming back. This too shall pass. And he took me through the steps. Now, the first thing that I did when I went in there was because they read the promises on those meetings over there that time. And when they read the promises, I realized that's what I want. When they said, you will know serenity and peace, that's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. I didn't care about anything else. Just please give me some of that peace, stuff, some of the serenity. Because I had spent the last 3 months before that on a suicide binge. Now, the suicide thing was very scary for me. My publishing company at the time, I had like published three or four more books since the famous index that was now gone. And the publishing company was doing well, and I was going to these publishing events down in places like New York, I was at one in Denver. I'm sitting in Denver, and I'm supposed to meet some people, salespeople, and this woman, who's probably in her 70s, looks at me and she says, would you mind if I join you? And she says, I'm waiting for somebody too. And I was like, how does she know I was waiting for somebody? But maybe, you know, that's okay. And so she sat down on the table in front of me, and then she began to tell me who I was. Everything about me, as if she could see straight through me. And I'm looking around and saying, who has told her this stuff? I'd never seen the woman before. I'm in a strange city, you know, nobody. And she tells me everything about me, that I was an Aquarian, that blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, whoa, she's just opening me up and looking in about all the pain I had. And so as we were talking, this young slip of a girl came over. She was looked almost like she was anemic, about almost a corpse. And she came over to her, and she gave her some orders. Do this, 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 and this. Sell me this, and I want to be on TV, blah, blah, blah. And when she left, as she was leaving, she came over to me, and she says, oh, nice aura, she goes. And she points up here, and she points up here, and she says, Serena and Michael. And then she left. And I said to this lady, I said, what was that? And she said, oh, that's the angel lady. I said, what? She says, yeah, it's the angel lady. So I goes, okay, that's good enough. That's good enough for me. She said, and I said, who's Serena and Michael? She said, well, you've got Serena up here on this side. You're an educator. You're all about children. And I'm going, what? She says, yes, you've got Serena. She takes care of you. And over here, you've got Michael, the archangel. He takes care of you. And these are my miracles. I'm going, what? I said, don't. I said, okay, that's enough of that. And so I leave. I leave and don't want to even hear that stuff. And I go back to Seattle. I close a bit of business. I come back to Seattle. And my life is down the tubes. I'm in Microsoft, I'm hiding under my desk, and I'm writing these awful curses against people that I have resentments. I mean, really bad curses, things that you don't want to hear about. Because these things happen. After all, we have brains to use. And so then, my dreams go black and white. And that was the scariest thing. I was afraid to go to sleep. They were so black and white. There was all kinds of fallings happening. I was always climbing up something and falling, 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 falling. Awful stuff. And I got to a point where I could not imagine living anymore. And even though I have children and I had people that love me, I could find nothing to make me want to stay in this planet. And so I decided that the best thing I could do, because I already knew about this, my friend who had worked in Belfast, he was an Englishman, and he was in the British Army, and he worked in defusing bombs in Belfast against the IRA. And he used to be my drinking partner as well. And one night I brought him home to my wife, and she threw us both out because we were both too drunk. And the next day he went down to the bridge and jumped off and killed himself. And that was showing me how you could do it. I mean, it was as clear as that. You get to a point, that's what you do. And that's where I was heading. I knew what to do. I knew exactly where to go. And so in my dreams, as they got worse and worse, I was afraid to go to sleep. I hated myself. I couldn't have anything, no love for my children or even think about them. And I hated my job, and everything was falling apart, really falling apart. And so one night in my dream, and this happened soon after I found AA, as I began to hear, "This too shall pass." One night in my dream, there was a car. I was in my car. There was a car in front of me. And we were driving onto the Aurora Bridge. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I was the one to get out, and I was going to jump. And so the car in front of me stopped, and it stopped in the wrong place, and so I had to stop behind it, and I wasn't right on the bridge yet. And the person in front gets out of the car, and guess what? In a complete black and white dream, this person was a beautiful blue lady. It was Serena. And she stepped out of the car, and she looked at me, and she smiled, and she went over, and she climbed up on the bridge, and she jumped. And I get out of my car, and I run over, and I look down, and she's falling. And when she gets to the bottom, she laughs, and she says, "Now you don't have to jump." And I wake up, and I am just in bits. I'm shaking. And from that moment on, my dreams came back into color. And I don't know what that was. I'm not saying it was anything, but it happened. And I became very serious then about AA. I became very serious about my sobriety, and I went to meetings every day. I became the person who cleaned the ashtrays at the Alano Club in Bellevue. And I stayed working at Microsoft. I was beginning to climb out from under the table. I actually did some work that year a little bit. They should never have paid me, but, you know, we still write bad software. And so... And so at the end of that that year, I was beginning to get some of the book. I still hadn't read the book, and I was looking for the easy way out, because I wasn't getting the serenity that I deserved. I needed more serenity, and you weren't giving it to me fast enough. And so there was an English man at the meeting, and because he was English, I had a huge resentment against him. In fact, I probably hated him. And I never spoke to him or anything. And so one day I got this phone call. It was the only phone call I ever got from Ireland. And the phone call was from my sister, and I knew exactly what it was. My mother was dying. And so she said, "You better get home. Your mother is dying." And I thought, oh my God, this is not good. So I went to my meeting, and I spoke at the meeting. I usually didn't speak, and I said, "I have to go to Ireland. I'll be gone for a while. My mother is dying." And this Englishman, who I hated, came over to me, and he said, "Now there's your opportunity." I said, "For what?" He said, "You can make amends." I said, "To whom?" "To your mother." I said, "For what?" "If you saw what she did to me." And so he said to me, "Look, you've got 9 hours on the flight coming back. Just think about it. Think about what I said." And so I hated him more, and I got on the plane, and over that 9 hours, something happened. And actually what happened was something else, because I had to change planes at Chicago. You know, Chicago is a huge place. There's all kinds of places you have to run to make flights. And so coming in on a domestic flight and going out on an international flight, you have to go across blah, blah, blah. And so I'm running like crazy. And as I'm passing this little booth, you know, one of those little kiosks that's in the middle of nowhere, and there's huge crowds around, and there's a couple of Indian people running there selling some junk in it. And as I'm passing it, suddenly this song comes out of this thing. And the song is in Gaelic. And the song is my mother's song. And I look around and I say, "What the hell?" And I say to them, "Where did you get that song?" And they said, "Oh, we don't control the music. We just sell things." And then I knew it. I knew it then. I said, "Okay." And I looked at my watch and I said, "Okay, she's just passed." And so I get on the plane, I get to London, I call my brother in Ireland, and he said, "Bad news for you." I said, "I know." I said, "She died at it." I gave him the time. He says, "How did you know?" And she had passed. And so I get to Ireland, and there's a funeral, and lo and behold, I'm the only person not drunk at the funeral. And that was something. I mean, for me, that was unbelievable. She had never seen me sober in her whole life since I started drinking, and there I was sober at her funeral. And so the funerals are a little bit different over there, and they have the coffin up in front of the altar, and people kind of stream by and they say a few prayers and things like that, and everybody waits until everybody's gone around, and then they move the body and the coffin out to the hearse, and they go to the graveyard. And the last person to come up was my drunken cousin, and he came up And he was so drunk that I thought he would knock the coffin off. Everybody did. Because he couldn't walk. He was so, the coordination between the brain and the foot wasn't happening. And so he'd think he'd put his foot down, but it would go 3 more inches. And so his unsteady gait coming up to the coffin was just freaking everybody out. But nobody said a word because they know how to deal with drunks over there. You just put up with them. That's the way it is. They either end up dead in an insane asylum. There is no solution. And so I had found a solution. I mean, you guys gave me this incredible, simple solution. And that whole thing about surrender, that thing that I thought about and was all wrong, and the idea of just changing to the winning side was the big deal for me. And so I drove people because I had a license that worked and I was sober, and everybody else was absolutely drunk at this funeral. And so then I came back here and I began to really get into the program. And I found I stayed with my sponsor, but I got a separate sponsor in a different city. And I found out that this geographical thing actually worked for AA as well, because wherever I went, I brought me and my AA with me, but also met people who were in AA. And so some of you know Johnny O'Hare, who's been 37, I think, years in the program. And Johnny, being an Irishman, but never having gone to Ireland, he colored me and he said to me, the next time you go to Ireland, I would like you to send me a postcard from Ireland. And I that was a resentment. I didn't want to do that because, you know, because you don't want to be thinking about people and you go back. And so he said, here's $5, buy me a postcard. I said, no. He says, take the $5, buy me a postcard and send it to me. And so I was trapped, and I went there, and of course, when I got the postcard, I had to think of Johnny and think of meetings, and I went to my first meeting in Ireland. And guess what? Everybody spoke like me. I wasn't different anymore. I was exactly that, just the same old drunk that I was in my drinking days. And so it felt right, and they spoke the same message that we spoke here, and it was fabulous. I was in my village. There was an AA meeting in my village. I didn't even know there was AA in Ireland. And there was. It had been there for years. And so it's a great secret over there. Because of the stigma is greater in some places than others. And so so Johnny taught me then that whenever I go, all I have to think about is that postcard. And when I send postcards, I send it to people in AA. And it reminds me of meetings. And I bring AA. And I bring you with me on my trips. So last year, July last year, I was going back to Ireland because another one of the great miracles happened. You know, I wrote something and there's a film festival. And I present at this film festival. And it's really a great honor to do that. And Johnny said to me, you know, I've never been to Ireland. And I said, why don't you come with me? And so he came to Ireland with me. And we went to find his people from the 1850s, and we found his mother's home and the gravesite and everything. It was a phenomenal, unbelievable thing. But we went to Galway City and we went to meetings every single day, Johnny and I. And so we would go into these meetings and there'd be Irish people, and even though I can't use any profane words, they use a lot of F words over there. And that's just normal talk. It's not like, you know. And so after about 2 meetings, Johnny said to me, boy, people in Ireland are very angry. I said, why do you think that? He said, well, they say that F word so much. I said, it's poetry, it's not anger, it's poetry. And then once he figured that out, he was the hero of the meetings. And he got to express himself a little differently over there. It was very, very good. The magic of it, of course, was that we got to share our lives sober in a new country, and to see how the impact is not on ourselves but on other people as well. And we got to help people over there. I sponsor people over there. I sponsor people here. The bad news is that Irish people, they don't like, you know, being told what to do. And so all of the people I'm sponsoring right now who are Irish are all out drinking. Every single last one of them. But every now and then, they get to enough pain where I can bring them to a meeting. And at some point, they'll be standing at that turning point and they'll know what to do, like I did. And so if there's any great message from that, is that we as a group can do something that I couldn't do alone. And that was the huge lesson for me. I realized today as I was coming down on the car with Mike, my co-pilot, that that I'm a changed person. I would never ask somebody to travel with me to any kind of a convention or something. I like being alone. I'm a geographical person. I like to go someplace where nobody knows me and I can do things and nobody will know what I did. But now, today, it's out there in front, and that makes me feel good. I know who I am again, and I like who I am again, and that's the beauty of it. I heard something from Paul, Dr. Paul, when I was in early sobriety that really connected with me. Two things that I loved, and it made me step closer and really set into the program. And one was that, you know, in our drinking days, there was a lot of good things happened, and there was a lot of bad things happened. But we knew deep down always that the trajectory was downhill. And at some point, we came to a place where it was too hard to go any further, and we stopped, and we made a decision. And then, as we came out the other side, and we began to come out, the trajectory was this way. But there was also bad things happened, and good things happened, and it gets confusing. But we still know that the trajectory is always that way. So it's like a big inverted V like that. And that was really, it meant a lot to me because I knew that my life had gone down, 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 and I stopped it there. And from that point on, it began to come this way. And you know, I have a history of sobriety today that I am so grateful for, unbelievably grateful. And everywhere I go, the miracles just do not stop. And so when I go to work, on a daily basis, I go to the University of Washington. I'm a cognitive neuroscientist. Now, believe it or not, I learned this from a meeting in Ballard. I was in the meeting, and this lady stood up and said, I'm celebrating today because I got accepted into the PhD program at the University of Washington. And I thought, oh, my God, how could she say that? Because I had drank myself out of the PhD program 20 years earlier. 1984, I signed up. I did my first quarter, and at the end of that quarter, the day of my exams, I got so drunk, I never finished them. And I went straight across the border, did a geographical to Canada. I spent 6 months up in Calgary in the freezing cold, Edmonton. And so much so that I learned how to drive in the snow. And every morning my nose was bleeding. Awful place to be alone. And I was alone up there because I was afraid and I was so ashamed. And I came back, and that night that lady said, I signed up today. And I thought, you know what? I have to go back and finish that. I shouldn't have done that. I should not have. So 20 years to the day, I went back and I went into Miller Hall up at UW and I walked down the hall and who did I meet? Only the old, now she was a small, older professor, the one I had walked out on that I had never shown up for her exam. And she says, where were you? And I go, oh my God. And she says, get back here and finish that. I go, ooh. And so I did what I was told. I went back and I finished it. And it changed everything because now I can do what it says in the book. I can contribute. I'm not out there taking anymore. I can contribute. When I go to work on a daily basis, I know I'm doing something that I can contribute. And I have the training and I have the knowledge and I have the brain to use. So that's it. I'm going to finish there. Thank you all. It's been a fabulous place to come to visit. And you are my family. Thank you.